Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollick, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this evening is Stephen Fesmire, also the Department of Philosophy at ETSU, and we're going to be discussing secular humanism. In particular, the topic is why I am a secular humanist, and Steve's going to give us the answer. Thank you for joining us this evening, Steve.
That's my pleasure. Good evening.
Okay. It seems like the appropriate place to begin, if you're going to explain why you're a secular humanist, is to tell us a little bit about what you understand secular humanism to be.
Sure, I'd be glad to. I guess I could start with the word secularism. It could be understood in many ways, and I'm not the czar to dictate in what way it should be used, so I'll provide one way that might be helpful for us. And I'll do that by contrasting it with the notion of tolerance. Intolerance could be understood as just basic active opposition to other faiths, whereas tolerance has a sort of live and let live attitude. You know, I'm okay, you're okay, 60s kind of, everyone get along with each other. But tolerance doesn't really have a reciprocity to it, a capacity to learn from others that goes out to others and learns from their points of view. So it's live and let live, but it has kind of a wall around it, whereas secularism has not a live and let live attitude, but a live and help live attitude about it. In secularism, we join together with others so that we reciprocally enhance our lives, and in this sense, secularism is something that can be super added onto particular faiths. So the question would then be, how does humanism fit into secularism? And it does so in two ways. First of all, humanism is one of many forms of secularism. There could be Christian secularism or Jewish secularism. Humanistic secularism. Second of all, in my view, the most fruitful destination for the evolution of secularism would be humanism. So that intolerance would become tolerance, become secularism, becomes an infinite variety of forms of naturalistic humanism. So what is humanism? Alexander Pope, sort of a proto-humanist, said, "Know then thyself, presume not God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man." So we might run with that and say that humanism is a philosophical outlook which seeks a meaningful and value-rich existence for self and for others from within common experience. So the idea here is that we secure meaningful and value-enhanced direction for our lives without appeal to some sort of otherworldly arena. And that doesn't mean that it's anyone who rejects a god or gods as a humanist. It's an affirmation of possibilities, a way of being ethically oriented in the world. So just because a Gallup poll says that 8% of Americans do not believe in God doesn't mean that 8% of Americans are humanists.
Okay. All right. When a lot of people hear the phrase secular humanism, they think of it as being a radical view of some sort. Do you consider yourself a radical? Do you consider secular humanism to be a radical view?
No, not really. In a sense, it's radical. I mean, it's a minority view, and it's socially radical in that many humanists envision a radical reconstruction of existing social institutions. But it's peculiar that it's seen to be radical because I simply believe that nature is wholly natural. Human beings are wholly human and moral values are valuable. That's humanism. So if you put your sociologist lenses on, you look around the world and you're surprised that the majority of humans believe that they're immortal and that nature was created supernaturally and that moral values spring from a supernatural being. So one has to ask oneself, which is really the more radical hypothesis? First of all, you have a naturally evolved planet inhabited by living organisms, and some of them, those living organisms, use their naturally evolved large brains to figure out how to get along with each other better. And then the other scenario is you have a supernaturally concocted planet inhabited by a species of immortal beings, and these beings are endlessly engaged in often very violent disputes about why the supernatural being put them there, what the supernatural creator would like for them to do next, to whom they should do it next. Now, the latter may be true. I don't deny that, but it's surely the more radical view, while the former is perhaps more congenial to common sense.
Okay. Now, embedded in your answer there is actually the beginning of the answer to my next questions. When I hear criticisms of secular humanism, they frequently come in one of three forms, or sometimes all three. One is that secular humanism is somehow wrong because it is anti-religious. Two, that secular humanism is defective because it doesn't believe in an afterlife. And many people believe if you don't have an afterlife, then life has no meaning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And lastly, that secular humanism is defective because it is in some sense anti-ethical. Now, I want to go back and talk about each of those in turn because it strikes me that we'll give you a chance to look at the criticisms and also tell us a little bit about what you see as the positive contribution of secular humanism. So
sure,
looking at the
sure.
at the first, is secular humanism anti-religious?
No. No. How should I deal with that? First, let's just make a distinction here between the religious quality of human experience, the religious, and religions, that is, institutional religions. Now, so that's the difference between the religious quality, an adjective, and religions, a noun. And the religious quality of human experience, I believe, is something that is trapped, very often trapped by historic religions, and that religious quality of experience needs to be emancipated from what often amount to encumbrances to the free development of the religious quality. Now, interestingly enough, traditional religionists and very militant, aggressive atheists agree about something, and namely that the supernatural and the religious are connected, and you can't separate the religious from the supernatural, and I disagree. I disagree with both, and so I guess I can't be very popular with either with either camp. I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. So it's the religious quality of experience is crucial.
Okay, could you say a little bit more about what you mean by the religious quality of experience?
Sure. There's a basic fundamental drive for aesthetic fulfillment, for meaning, for value that I think all human beings share. I don't say that dogmatically, but as a matter of empirical, I say it with empirical support. We all have a basic fundamental drive for meaning and value. The religious impulse is part of this.
Okay, so
this drive. So we want to yeah. emancipate this drive for meaning and value from the entrapment, the imprisonment of historic religions, because they've been suffocated and stifled and strangled often, that this drive has by religion. So I think that's a thumbnail sketch of what I would mean by this religious drive.
Okay. All right. And so it's a desire for meaning, for value, for perhaps improvement, self-improvement, improvement of others, and so on.
Certainly.
Okay.
Certainly.
Continue with your vein then. So what you're wanting to say is humanism is not anti-religious, but it is anti-religion, at least if by religion you mean certain forms of organized religion.
In effect, I wouldn't want to speak for all humanists in that.
Right.
But it's anti-religion insofar as religion has been entrapping. Yes.
Okay.
That's what I want to say.
Well, now, to elaborate this a bit, does when you talk about the in ways in which organized religion have often entrapped people, that I take it that's a criticism you have of certain forms of modern contemporary religion. I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit more. How do they trap us? What do you see as the limitations of at least some modern religions?
Well, how about if we contrast an affirmation of humanism with something like the Christian Apostles' Creed, and use that as an inroad? The Apostles' Creed is this sort of, it summarizes a basic checklist of supernatural beliefs that are entry points into the door. You know, into the group. So I believe in God the Father, check. Maker of heaven and earth, check. And in Jesus Christ, His only begotten Son, our Lord, check. Who was conceived of the Holy Spirit, check. Born of the Virgin Mary, check. Now, none of those have anything to do with getting along better in the world. None of those have to do with intellectual, aesthetic, moral fulfillment. But take a basic affirmation of humanism, humanist principles, and I have here beside me just one example of that. We believe in an open and pluralistic society, and that democracy is the best guarantee of protecting human rights from authoritarian elites and repressive majorities. We cultivate the arts of negotiation and compromise as a means of resolving differences and achieving mutual understanding. We are concerned with securing justice and fairness in society and with eliminating discrimination and intolerance. We believe in supporting the disadvantaged and the handicapped so that they will be able to help themselves. We attempt to transcend divisive parochial loyalties based on race, religion, gender, nationality, creed, class, sexual orientation, or ethnicity, and strive to work together for the common good of humanity, et cetera, et cetera. So with the humanist affirmation, you have people who are speaking about the world, getting along better in the world, not just a checklist of affirmations about supernatural beliefs and otherworldly beliefs.
Okay. Could you elaborate a bit more on that, on how you see this as being? I mean, I think the contrast is fairly clear. Could you elaborate a bit more on the nature of this criticism?
Sure. There are various points of criticism that one could make. I think historically, most Western religions, certainly Christianity, has cultivated a distrust of human intelligence and of, you know, human moral capacities. And what I think we've ended up with is a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. We don't believe that humans are capable of moral greatness alone. And so we neglect to cultivate those very capacities because we seem to think that we're morally inept. So we neglect to make the world a source of hope when it could be made that. Another criticism is that traditional religion has been in its supernaturalism has been has placed itself and its values and its principles literally beyond critique. So these values have to be blindly accepted because they're supreme critical, super empirical. That led someone like Voltaire to say those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. He also claimed that Christianity tended to block the progress of humanity, and that may be a bit extreme, but we can take our own state's recent regression to the days of the Scopes Monkey Trial as perhaps a point in Voltaire's favor. Add to this that the notion that there's ultimate good at work in every evil event, there's no genuine tragedy, and that's a pessimistic belief if I ever saw one, but it's a belief that's robed in the garments of optimism. Finally, consider the thousands of years of authoritarian control, of bickering and bloodshed brought about by disagreements about what the divine will wants us to do, so that a growing number of people yearn for a more inclusive, a more expansive, a more socially responsive, a more ecologically sensitive framework that will enable and encourage all human beings with no sectarian bias at all to achieve the realizations of their own human capacities. And that's simply the outlook of humanism.
Okay. All right, let's pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who may be tuning in late. I'm Hugh LaFollette, and this is Ideas and Issues. My guest this evening is Stephen Fesmire, and he's explaining to us why he is a secular humanist. Earlier, I said that there were three standard objections to secular humanism. We've just talked about the first, that it's anti-religious. The next one is that secular humanism is thought to be deficient because it does not believe in an afterlife. And for many people in our culture, apparently to not have an afterlife is to live without hope. Do secular humanists believe in an afterlife? Well, let's just start there, and then we can go back and talk about whether you think that's good or bad.
Yeah, I guess it depends on what you mean by afterlife. Certainly in the standard sense, no. That is, I don't believe that nor do other secular humanists by and large believe that they're metaphysical nuggets or soul substances. So I'm a metaphysical nugget called Stephen Fesmire, and this soul persists unchanging through life and through death. I'm not going to dogmatically deny that. It's a matter for science, and the evidence hasn't exactly been impressive to date concerning that. But there's a practical upshot to this question of the afterlife, and I think people have ignored that because they take it too literally. But it does serve a function. really the best humanist response is not, well, there's nothing but worms and dirt left of me when I'm gone. There's a typical response, but I don't think it's a very good one. Ultimately, this is a question about the meaning of life. What is life's meaning? How about something like this? The meaning of life is handing down to the next generation or the generations to come the civilization we've inherited, hopefully with some increment of added meaning. And that's life after death. But that's life after death from a socially responsible standpoint rather than the standard egoistic standpoint. So it goes beyond this sort of mawkish, sickly, selfish obsession with my personal salvation that's so prevalent in Christianity. We become preoccupied with another world only to the detriment of interest in aiding this one. So there is a sense in which afterlife makes sense. We transform the world with which we interact while we're alive. So there's really more to the I or the me, the self, than just the bag of skin. And that's why biographies, for example, don't end with the death of the figure being talked about. They take in the influences of what that person did and said. So in this sense, there is an afterlife.
Could we elaborate 1 minute on that, the idea of a biography? One sort of very ordinary way, I'm trying to see if this captures the thrust of what you're wanting to say. In one sort of ordinary way, if I'm an author and I write the great American novel and I die, there's a sense in which I continue to live, namely that my novel's still there, it still has influence, people still read it. And what you're saying, in a sense, is that each of us may write a novel. It may not be bound and published, but each of us effectively writes a novel by the way we live.
Yes.
And that continues to have influences and effects long after this body's gone.
That's right. And the novel writing metaphor is a fine metaphor because we're all composing narratives alongside each other, and these narratives are interlocking one with the other. And we have to co-compose them. We have to figure out how to continue those narratives meaningfully alongside each other. So it's a fine narrative, a fine metaphor to talk about our ethical responsibilities as well.
Okay. Well, now, when people talk about an afterlife, certainly one of the things that they have in mind is that they think an afterlife is needed to get people to act morally.
Right.
That you have to have promise of eternal reward in order to get people to do the right thing, and you have to have promise of eternal punishment to keep people from doing the wrong thing.
Yes.
Does a humanist see any credence in that claim? Or if...
That it has acted in that way, there's credence in that claim. That it need act in that way, necessarily. Certainly not. In fact, I think that points out the, in some sense, an immorality of failing to believe in our mortality. Just to give an example, there was a letter to the editor in the Johnson City Press recently, a fairly typical letter. Someone was threatening someone else who stole her property, and she said, "I'm not the one she has to answer to. There's an all-seeing eye who knows all and sees all. Be sure your sins will find you out." Now, in this case, in case any listener isn't familiar with Russian religion, someone just came into the country. This refers to a widely held belief that an all-loving and forgiving being is going to cast the vast majority of the human species into some sort of burning pit in which the hurting will go on forever. And that seems to apply to anyone who doesn't think and say what their family and religion have taught them to think and say. God is a socially useful construct. This is no big news. I don't mean to put this real crassly, but there's a sense in which Santa Claus does for children sort of the same thing that God does for adults. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows when you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. I don't mean to put that crassly. The Christian and Jewish traditions and the Muslim tradition has been cultivated in a highly sophisticated fashion, and I grew out of that tradition, so I don't mean it crassly. But it does point out the fact that God is socially useful. But I have to ask this, and as a humanist, I ask this, are most humans actually only capable of a morality based on the fear of being smacked in the face at the end of the journey, or of getting some sort of reward at the end of the journey? And I think that's a very low opinion of human potential, and I just flatly don't believe it. I don't have such a static view of human nature, that humans have been inherently sinful since Adam bit the fruit and the like. The problem, I think, is simply that our culture hasn't evolved far enough yet to realize social forms that will enable a more broadly humanistic or at least secularist outlook.
Okay. Now, you, in a way, you've already, some of the things you've already said anticipate a response to the last objection, but it's time now to talk about it and elaborate on it. The last objection is that secular humanism is somehow anti-religious. Certainly when I hear a lot of the discussions in the public media these days, there's sort of a simultaneous attack on secular humanism and immorality.
Right.
That as if the two were the same. The assumption is that,
right,
that somehow secular humanists either don't care about morality, or
yes,
if they do, they just don't have the volition to be decent people.
Mm-hmm.
Their wickedness just, you know, carries the day.
Right,
I'm not
right.
sure what the metaphor is.
Right.
Are secular humanists interested in ethics? Is that a valid criticism?
Are they interested in anything else? Would be a better question.
Okay. Explain.
Sure. Sure. And my main focus in philosophy is ethics, in fact. Perhaps a better way to start this would be to talk about education a little bit, a way of shedding light on the ethical question. What a liberal education strives for is, I think, something like the liberation of students' energy so that they can realize their own potentials. Potentials to do what? What? To be humane. Potentials to be compassionate. To be informed members of the world. And that world, as they will already have discovered, is not usually particularly concerned with their own inner welfare. And liberal education works when such students, in turn, are committed themselves to securing the material and the social prerequisites for the liberation of others. And this leads to further enrichment of our cultural resources in a nice spiraling or circular fashion. Now, that's a humanistic ideal. It's not a supernaturalist ideal at all. It doesn't say anything about divine commands. It doesn't say anything about supernaturally revealed values. And it need not say anything about such values. It upholds and nurtures those values of intellectual vitality, of humane feeling, of receptiveness to beauty, to which religions at their best, and certainly Christianity included, at their best, religions have long been committed to this, long before the emergence of secular humanism. But humanism does so, cultivates these capacities without doctrinal encumbrances, you might say. So that helps to point out some matters about ethics. So on to ethics proper, I'll just mention something about my own work, perhaps. I've been focusing primarily on the psychology of moral deliberation. The theory I've worked with is that how in fact do human beings make moral decisions? If we can figure out how we do it, then we might be able to ask the question, of course, about how we could do it better. So what are the facts of moral deliberation? It seems that we do something like this. We imagine alternative scenarios for acting. So we find ourselves in some sort of problem, moral situation. We've got to deal with some difficulties. And we forecast consequences in our imagination of enacting alternative scenarios. And what we try to do is to organize the various contending values, conflicts that are in the situation. Now, I'm just putting that forth as something of a fact. It may be wrong. If it's wrong, then it's flat out wrong, and it can be shown to be wrong. That we should deliberate that way is just a moot point. It's like saying we should communicate by means of language or we should feel erotic desire. It's moot. We just do deliberate that way. That is that's the proposal. So that's how we make moral decisions, or that's how I'm proposing that we do that we in fact make moral decisions. So how might we do it better is the significant moral question. What we need is moral standards, of course, of some sort. So in contrast to traditional standards, divine command, say, thou shalt not do such and such, these commands provide a rigid moral governance. And what we need, I think, is practical guidance in getting along in the world. We need to discern methods of moral decision-making that will help us to do that, to get along in the world better. There are methods of surgery that are better than others. There are methods of farming that are better than others. There are certainly methods of moral decision-making that are better than others. And what I would propose is that what we need is something like an ecological ideal, where conflicting tendencies in a situation, conflicting values, disagreements, are treated with an eye to the way they affect values elsewhere in a situation or an ecological system. The ecology metaphor, and I call my own view ecological humanism, highlights that any individual part of a system is intelligible only when it's understood in its interrelations with other parts of the system. So basically, it's just a theme that we're all in it together. And we have to recognize that we're not private, atomic. We're not separated from others as a sack of skin, as a disembodied mind, a soul, from our natural and social surroundings. And the needs and aspirations of others are features of the world that can't be ignored. So in our moral decision-making, we have to discover how others' life stories, we had the narrative metaphor before, how these life stories can be meaningfully continued alongside our own. So immoral conduct is not deficiency in one's capacity to follow divine commands or whatnot. It really stems from a maldeveloped moral imagination.
Okay. We've just got about 20 seconds here. If you could, again, go back and summarize very quickly what you take humanism to be for the listeners, I think that would be helpful.
Okay, sure. The idea is simply that it is a this-worldly attempt to secure value-enhanced direction for our lives, and it does so simply without any appeal whatsoever to an otherworldly or supernatural arena. And, well, that's about the sum of it.
Okay. I've been talking this evening with Stephen Fesmire about why he is a secular humanist. This has been Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good evening.